WZRD Chicago. Ruth Needleman,
I'm a retired professor of labor studies at Indiana University. I also taught some courses on global solidarity and global movements at the School of the Art Institute.
You've organized a seminal series of events, exhibits at the Uri Eichen Gallery on the 50th anniversary of the military coup in Chile that brought in a fascist dictatorship.
Well, it was brutal, and there were tens and thousands of people murdered and disappeared
right.
in the most brutal fashion. But none of it would have been possible without the role of the U.S. directly to overthrow the Allende government. From the president and Henry Kissinger, his advisor, down to George Meany and the AFL, they conspired to make sure that the government would fail and that chaos would reign and that the military would be able to step in.
How is it you got down there? Well, just cover some background.
You
were teaching.
I was teaching Latin American literature at University of California in Santa Cruz. And I set up in 1970, I think it was one of the first in the country, a Latin American studies program. And I had been politically involved for some time. And when I saw and read about what was happening in Chile, I thought, whoa, I got to be there. I got to see this peaceful road to socialism. And so I took a quarter sabbatical. I took a leave of absence in the summer. And I went to Chile for 10 months and had some contacts with a group of North Americans, U.S. people, in a group called the Source of North American Information, or FIN in Spanish. Excuse me. And so we put out a monthly newsletter about U.S. imperialism and what it was up to. But while I was there, obviously, first thing I noticed, and literally the first day, this was not a very peaceful road because the opposition had absolutely no intention of giving up power. But it got bigger and uglier while I was there. At first, I didn't do much, but there was a very big counter-revolutionary strike in October of 1972. It was known as the Stoppage of October. A lot of people around the world thought that truck drivers had started it. It was actually truck owners. And it was started by a coalition of very powerful right-wing people in Chile who were planning to pull down the government. The idea of the strike was to paralyze the distribution of all goods and food and everything else. And these truck owners took their trucks and blocked all the roads. And the right wing was sure that people on the left would confront them in the streets. But instead, the workers of Chile built alternative distribution networks, defeated the strike, and built organizations in all the industrial corridors, in every factory, and every neighborhood to handle distribution, education, healthcare, etc. And so I was seeing something I'd never seen before. We talk about class consciousness as if it occurs if you work for a living. But what I saw was a different kind of class consciousness. And I'll tell you one story, one of my favorites. The second day I was there, I went out to catch a bus. And people told me, no matter how crowded the bus is, you should get on. So the first bus came by. I think it was one of those little micro Volkswagen minibuses. There were people hanging from the windows and the doors holding on to each other. I said, no way. And then another bus came by, and people were hanging from the windows, hanging on each other's waist down the steps, literally out the door. So the third bus came by, and I ran up to the door, grabbed somebody's waist, held on until I slowly got pushed up into the bus. of course, the crisis with busing and transport was because the U.S. had an economic blockade that prevented any spare parts from reaching Chile, which meant that when a bus broke down, it was gone. When a truck broke down, it was gone, because these were General Motors products, Ford products. But anyhow, I get on the bus, and I slowly get pushed towards the rear, and I hear what sounds like an argument. So I push closer, and there's a woman. Nobody in the bus was middle class, because they didn't drive buses. These were all working people from the outskirts of Santiago coming in to work. I hear her yelling at this guy, "You are so uneducated. You don't know anything." And I'm thinking, ooh. Then she starts to explain, because he's saying, "There's no, I can't get cooking oil, I can't get gas, I can't do this, I can't do that, there's no food." And she says, not stupid or mister, she says, "Compañero, you have to understand that this is the fault of the U.S. And she begins to explain the economic blockade to him, and I'm thinking to myself, this is class consciousness. She could connect the dots and was educating a fellow citizen into what was really going on behind the scenes in Chile. It was very different from just thinking you're a worker. Workers don't have class consciousness, and that's particularly clear in the U.S. these days when they join in right-wing fascist demonstrations against black people and brown people and women and abortion rights and all this other stuff. But anyhow, that was my introduction. But after the October strike, I volunteered to work at the National Publishing House to help them put together a book on the strike, which wasn't really a strike. It was a stoppage because there was no workers involved, except for some high-level engineers and white-collar workers, bankers, and things like that. As I put together the chronology, I thought, geez, I should go interview the leaders of the right wing. I spoke fluent Spanish. I was very educated. I'd done the chronology, so I knew everybody by name. I started at the bottom of the five leaders of the coup, eventually. The one that I started with was the truck owner, because he was pushed to the forefront. And his name was Leon Villarín. Villain is what I would say. Anyhow, the whole idea, as I met these people, each one introduced me to the next one higher. So by the time I got to the top leaders of the right wing, I was introduced by trusted people. And unfortunately or fortunately, I'm a really good liar. And I said I was sympathetic. I taught at the University of California. I couldn't deal with the kind of chaos and shortages here. And so they talked to me. And I continued to interview them the whole time I was in Chile. And that's when I really learned that class consciousness has two faces.
What do you mean when you say two faces?
A lot of people think that rich people are class conscious. No, rich people like their wealth. Class conscious means counter-revolutionary. Consciously counter-revolutionary. Consciously fighting the workers. These people, I'll just tell you what the head of the National Association of Manufacturers told me over a glass of wine. He said, look, we're actually thankful for the Allende government. And I said, why is that? And he said to me, because now we know everyone we need to kill, which is exactly what they went about doing. And so I was learning about movements, organization, class consciousness, in ways that books can't tell you. Seeing the hatred and the anger of these upper middle class people, who they basically hated the workers. I don't know how they thought they were going to eat. But anyhow, that led me to start looking at the ties to the U.S. Now, I had done some reading and research. I knew that the American labor movement was doing dastardly things around the world, but I never understood how pivotal their role was, not only in bringing down the Allende government, but by identifying progressive workers so they could be killed, eliminated, buried, dropped from airplanes, put in the Atacama Desert, or whatever. And so I started then trying to track some of this, because one of the people I interviewed headed up an organization of white-collar employees, which had been created by the American Institute for Free Labor Development, run by the AFL-CIO. This organization, it was called CUPROCH, Professional Organization of Unions, it said, of workers. Some of the workers, for example, in this coalition were some of the largest landowners in the country who called themselves labor technicians. This was the plantation owners calling themselves workers and joining CUPROCH. CUPROCH mainly organized highly professional workers like engineers and bankers, and they brought in any grouping that was committed to overthrowing the government. And it was done, Julio Bassan, the person I interviewed, had studied at the AFL-CIO's Education Institute outside of Washington, D.C., called Front Royal. It was the American Institute for Free Labor Development's Education Institute. And a lot of people have talked about the harm that AFIELD, that's the acronym for the American Institute, did, but I don't think people realized that they were not about doing reactionary education. They were about counter-revolution. And the people that led AFIELD actually came out of U.S. intelligence. George Meany, probably not, but he cooperated closely. But the original head, Serafino Romualdi, and Bill Daugherty had all worked in counterintelligence and intelligence during World War II. For the U.S. intelligence, it was the predecessor to the CIA. It was called the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. And they also worked for the Counterintelligence Corps. So the so-called labor people who set up the American Institute for Free Labor were really right-wing cold warriors dedicated to eliminating communism from everywhere. But what's important to note, especially in Chile, 75% of the organized workers belong to the Communist or Socialist Party. They were the enemy. In other words, almost the entire working class of Chile was viewed by the AFL-CIO as the enemy. They were organizing against U.S. corporations. AFIELD had on its board corporations that refused to recognize unions in the United States. Grace, who owned Grace Lines and plantations all through Central America, was the chairman of the board.
W.R. Grace. Most people aren't.
I have an ancient brain. But anyhow, this all is wrapped up by President Kennedy in 1961, and it was organized directly in response to the Cuban Revolution. And as far as the U.S., President Nixon and Kissinger were concerned, we will not let, said Kissinger, another country go communist under our nose, as if the people of the country don't matter. It didn't begin with the alliance. Even though the AFIELD was part of the alliance, it was already doing this counter-revolutionary work starting during World War II. And I have all kinds of evidence of CIA, U.S., AFL intervention in the unions in Chile from the 40s on. It's just that it changed face. Just like today, we don't have AFIELD. We have the Solidarity Center. Is it different? Yes. How different? Not much. Because it still follows U.S. foreign policy priorities, absolutely. The U.S. AFL-CIO doesn't care about any country that doesn't have U.S. corporations in it. And they don't care about much about workers who work for non-U.S. corporations. And so, as one of the leaders of this organization told me, is that we don't go down there to build up the unions that exist. We go there to build unions we can work with, which means unions we create, anti-communist unions. And the lengths to which they went is unbelievable. But once Allende was elected, AFIELD pulled all of its in-country people out and expanded its programs in the U.S., and there was a 400% increase in the number of Chileans brought to the U.S. to learn counterinsurgency. The other head, after Serafino Romualdi, Bill Daugherty, said in an interview that we don't teach anymore how to do collective bargaining. We teach the unions how to get rid of the communists. That was 75% of the labor force. And so they had a lot of killing to do. But without the names and the help of the AFL, and Meany even said, we are so useful because we are on the street face to face with people. The U.S. government can't do the kind of work we do, and I would add seditious work that they do. And so all through this, I was seeing the tail end of it in Chile because I was seeing the already created Cuproach and the other things. When I came back to the U.S., and mind you, by the time I left Chile, the right-wing people had discovered that I wasn't who I said I was. And actually, because I was meeting with the right-wing leaders, the Chilean Communist Party thought I was CIA. So I was accompanied out of the country with bodyguards. I was young, stupid maybe, but I think too passionate to think about my own safety. But when I came back to the U.S., I went to New York and D.C. I quit my job at the university to do research on AFIELD. And I did what few other people have done. I interviewed its leaders with the same line I used in Chile. I am so sympathetic. And they talked to me. That's why I heard them say things like, you know, we don't work, we try to create unions we can work with. San Francisco Labor Council exposed it. There were members of the newspaper guild that opposed it. People didn't know what was going on. It wasn't very public. And most books written about the coup talk about the CIA, and they don't mention the AFL-CIO. But the AFL-CIO played a strategic role, not a minor role. They helped identify the opposition to the United States. They went out of their way to build counter-revolutionary forces. And working with what was called the International Trade Secretariats, it was the predecessor to, you know, the kind of Metal Workers Federation, the other international work-based federations, except that the ITSs were completely controlled by the Cold Warriors. And so they became a conduit for both personnel and money into Chile under Allende. AFIELD was being watched by the Congress because they hated George Meany and they hated AFIELD, not across the board.
Which Congress? The U.S. Congress? Or
U.S. Congress, okay. Yes.
This is WGRD Chicago.
No, there were some of the people I interviewed in the State Department, and the State Department had always been a divided body between right and liberal. never more less than liberal, but liberal. And I interviewed some of the liberals in the State Department. The Congress itself had voted after a report was done on the work of AFIELD to defund it because they said it wasn't doing anything of any good. But that didn't really stop it. But AFIELD could not interfere in the internal affairs of unions in other countries. The way it did it was through the ITS. So people who were leadership in AFIELD were also very critical in the ITSs based on their job. For example, the PTTI was the Postal Telegraph International Trade Secretariat, and some of the leaders of AFIELD were leaders of that ITS. That ITS could bring money into the country, could bring in personnel, many of whom were CIA. It was a conduit for money and personnel to go into Chile and help with the counter-revolution.
What is an ITS?
The International Trade Secretariats were formed right after World War I, and it was supposed to be an organization that would bring together metal workers from all over the world, postal workers from all over the world, retail clerks, but it became completely corrupted over time, and they were really a tool of the Cold War. But right around the mid-60s, when the U.S. was funneling money into Chile because Allende was rising to power, because the people of Chile were tired of being basically enslaved by U.S. corporations, exploited. All the wealth of Chile was leaving Chile, owned by the copper companies in the U.S., Anaconda, Kennecott. Also, ITT owned the telephone company. So the U.S. multinationals had enormous power in Chile. So what the corporations did is give AFIELD or ITS personnel a list of all their employees so they could contact them and help them to plan ways of having AFIELD help to take over their unions. Because their unions, for example, the union in postal wanted to nationalize the postal service. Well, you can imagine ITT and all these other people didn't like that. It was many roads to bringing people into Chile to help undermine and undercut the unions, which were very powerful in Chile, but they were completely dominated by the socialist and communist members.
The film that you had mentioned, The Battle of Chile.
Yes. There are three parts to it. It's quite long, but it follows the events. Patricio Guzman was the filmmaker, internationally acclaimed filmmaker. Tells the story of the battle for Chile and the rising right wing, the counter-revolutionary attempts, the organizing efforts of workers. There is incredible footage of workers who took over their factories and were organizing distribution, organizing transportation. It's an incredible documentary.
It became a threat to the government, even.
There was pressure after the October stoppage. That's when he brought Pinochet into the government, because to get them to stop the stoppage, there were some compromises. It was a bad compromise. There were different opinions within the Popular Unity government, and the Socialist Party tended to be more to the left, the Communist Party a little bit more conciliatory, but that doesn't speak to the members, because the members were fighting for their lives, and they took over the factories. And the October strike that was supposed to paralyze the country actually put the workers in power in industry. It was very exciting to see it.
Can you talk about what a commando was? The workers organized
Well, there are two different kinds of commandos. There was the Comando Gremial and a Gremio, which was the organization that did all the right-wing organizing, is a guild. It's not a union. And they were gremios of owners and not workers. And that's important because people get confused that the truckers were truck drivers instead of truck owners and things like that. Every community, every factory, and every industrial strip organized commandos that met regularly, organized activity in the neighborhoods and along the strips, so that the more hoarding of food and vitals that happened, the more they set up their own distribution networks. They were actually called HOP, JAPs. They rose to the occasion and were the slogan of the workers leading up to the coup was workers to power. Trabajadores al poder.
And there were people
marching. Create popular power. And they meant power in the real sense. But Allende was also walking a tightrope because the U.S. had blockaded all the loans to the country. It had blockaded its selling its copper, which was its main product and the source of all foreign reserves. It was really hard. That's why the last big strike that really hurt the government was a copper strike. But it was led by Kuproch. And if you remember, I said engineers, land technicians. It was organized by right-wing conservative forces to try and convince the skilled and white-collar professionals to support the military intervention. It didn't stop copper production, but it really cut the production back, and it created chaos throughout the economy. And meanwhile, through the ITSs and through AID, money was flooding Chile to support the right wing. There's a report that came out just after the coup on U.S. covert activities by the CIA in Chile, and it outlines everything that they did. Of course, a lot of it is blanked out, but as someone who lived there and interviewed and knew these people, I could fill in a lot of the blanks. But it was all aimed at paralyzing the country, making life so hard. And I learned something very important about breaking the middle class away from the working class while I was in Chile. Because if you want to alienate the middle class, I would argue, take away their toilet paper. The biggest producer of toilet paper was the owner of the biggest right-wing newspaper, El Mercurio, that received more direct funding from the CIA than almost any other organization. But it didn't just go to that. They found in the river running through Santiago tens of thousands of rolls of toilet paper thrown away. You could get it if you were dealing in the black market. If you were poor, you got it in a popular basket that the government provided. But the middle class didn't have access to toilet paper or cooking oil or matches. They didn't have stoves lit themselves. I mean, it was really hard. Every time you saw a line anywhere in Santiago, you would run to get in it, hoping that there was something you could get like matches or cooking oil. Rarely the case. It was just a constant sabotage.
I wanted to ask you about the housing projects that were offered to people in unions.
This is how it worked. The housing project was part of AFIELD. The person in charge of the housing project was military intelligence. Just so you understand that AFIELD had the head of personnel was naval intelligence. The head of the housing project was intelligence. These were all military people. And the housing project, and I would argue AFIELD in general, was more about counter-revolution and subversion than it ever was about education. They called it an educational institute. The housing project was offered to unions who loved the U.S., but almost none of them ever got a housing project. But to apply for it, you had to fill out a four-page questionnaire. You had to identify the political affiliation of every member of the union. You had to list all the, you had to provide information that only the CIA cared about. And I interviewed someone who worked for AFIELD but left because he realized that it was a subversive unit and not an educational institute. His name was Joseph Polizzi. And he had run the Catholic Relief Services food program in Latin America. And AFIELD asked him to run a food program for them, but they never let him set it up. And he said, you won't find in the AFIELD archives very much about the housing project because all of those applications, pages and pages of information on everybody at the CIA. And this guy also explained that when he took the job at AFIELD, he immediately became very suspicious because the heads of all these programs were military intelligence. They traveled all the time. One day in Argentina, fly back to D.C. Next day in Chile, fly back to D.C. He said if these were trade unionists, they wouldn't travel like that. And where did that money come from? To travel day and night back and forth carrying information. And so they blackballed him completely, but he nonetheless had a lot of, he also pointed out, which is why he was so paranoid. I interviewed him in my New York apartment, and we set it for 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He would not do an interview anywhere but at my apartment. He came and would not take his coat off, would not accept a glass of water, and I thought to myself, this guy is paranoid. But then he explained to me how AFIELD dealt with people who didn't agree with them. And he outlined three methods. One was exploding a cyanide pill, causing someone to have a heart attack. The next one was pushing someone in front of a car or in front of a train. And the third one was actually injecting blood contaminated with, what's the disease of the blood? I'm going to forget. But anyhow, he was afraid for his life because he named six people who had been murdered, he thought. And that included, which is unbelievable, the founder of AFIELD, Serafino Romualdi, Mr. Intelligence, Mr. CIA, but he wanted an ambassadorship when George Meany removed him from AFIELD, and he didn't get one. And he was about...
Talking to Ruth Needleman, labor history professor. So go ahead, yes. Ruth.
Serafino Romualdi was removed by George Meany as head of AFIELD. He agreed to that on the basis that he'd be given an ambassadorship. He did not get an ambassadorship and decided to go public about it. And then he had a heart attack. A lot of suspicion, no confirmation. Polizzi went on to be a college professor. He was not a fly-by-night crazy. He was a very educated, a very justice-oriented Catholic who could not believe what was being done in the name of labor. He died, but much later in life. They didn't kill him. He's the guy I interviewed twice in my apartment. What's clear, you know, a lot of people know that the AFIELD was doing subversive work, but I think the balance in the analysis is wrong. It was mainly an operative organization, not an education organization. Education was subservient to intelligence gathering. Just to read you something that the director, Bill Daugherty, said in an interview, not even with me, he said, we're no longer training in terms of how to organize and collective bargaining and form a union. We trained them in how we had to expel the communists from our unions back in the days of the CIO and how we found the methods they used to infiltrate our unions and how to combat communist attempts to infiltrate the trade union movement in Latin America. It's because of that training, he says, on how to keep communists and fascists, they brought the fascists to power, out of the labor movement that we got the label of being CIA because we did it very effectively. It'd be hard to separate the CIA and AFIELD because so many people that worked there came out of the intelligence community. Now, what I learned from people in the State Department is how much they hated George Meany, the AFL, and AFIELD. They tried repeatedly to defund it. By the way, the Congress did, U.S. Congress, did a special investigation into the housing project. And what they found was that the housing projects that were promised were mainly never built. Those that got built were absolutely falling apart, that the cost to live there was above what any worker could have afforded. And in order to live there, you had to be cleared by the U.S., and they had a military person in charge of every housing project. Mm-hmm. One of the ways when this maritime union that was very closely allied with naval intelligence here and also there.
They would be people who operated the coastal steamers or the ports.
Right, but it was also people in the Navy. Okay. This union had naval officers in it. So don't confuse it with the ILWU or one of our labor longshore unions, because it wasn't that. But when they didn't give Komach the housing project they had promised, they gifted a ship-to-shore radio system that was used throughout the coup. AFL-CIO paid for the communication systems used by the Chilean and U.S. Navy during the coup, and it was U.S. naval people, intelligence, who ordered the death of the two Americans who were killed during the coup, Charles Horman and Frank Teruggi. It took 40 years to get that information out. And let me just mention that Charlie Horman's wife, Joyce Horman, will be here in Chicago this coming weekend at the gallery, the Uri Eichen Gallery at 21st and Halsted on Friday night. Joyce and will be there along with Janice Teruggi Page, who is the sister of the other American who was killed. There will be a discussion of all of the disappeared, how many people were murdered. There's going to be a picture exhibit of the excavation of a mine in which they found hundreds of corpses. The Uri Eichen Gallery. And then on Saturday, the Gene Siskel Center is showing the fabulous Costa Gavras film called Missing, which is about the search for Charles Horman. And it's with Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek, but Joyce and Janice will be there and will be speaking there as well, 2 o'clock sharp.
Getting back to the exhibit, this months-long commemoration around the 50th anniversary of the coup, you've had people involved in cultural activities that enabled a continuation of the memory.
An obstinate memory. Guzman goes back to Chile. He's meeting with young college students and high school students, and they're all telling him that Pinochet saved the country, that Allende was a dreamer, but he never really accomplished anything. And then he showed them the battle for Chile, 3 parts, and when the lights come on, they are all sobbing. They had no idea what had happened. It's still incredibly emotional, and the student uprisings of 2018 and 2019 brought so much of it back. They were treated almost as cruelly as Pinochet treated people, because what they did was shoot at them, but not shoot to scare. They shot their eyes out.
The similarities between the way the police deal with demonstrators in this country.
Very similar.
Canisters that are causing serious injuries. There's a point to be made, I think, about the similarity between the destruction of civil society to allow for the introduction of fascism. And fascism in this country,
it is totally conflated with white supremacy. In Germany, it was the corporate state and that alliance that established fascism. Although racism was at the heart of Nazism, because you have to have an internal enemy in order to unite the right wing. And the internal enemy turns out to be working people and poor people and black people and brown people, immigrants, etc. And I think there are a lot of parallels. First of all, there were many attempted coups before the actual coup, not unlike January 6th. And I think we are foolish to think that January 6th was anything but a first try. Just like in Chile, it was followed by right-wing strikes. Then it was followed by, you know, interference with commerce. I mean, it follows patterns. And a lot of it is also based on trying to divide the working class. Now, in Chile, they had a very unfortunate law that distinguished blue-collar and white-collar workers from each other. White-collar workers, professional employees, got paid at a higher rate. Also, they received higher benefits, and if they worked for a U.S. corporation, they were paid in dollars. When Allende came into office, he didn't stop the high wages or anything, but he stopped the payment in dollars. And that was the greed sign that helped organize the professional employees at the copper mines to go out on strike because they were losing their dollar payments and some of their benefits.
To stoke them to get involved
right.
in the counter-revolution. The fact about January 6th is that in that crowd, you had CIA agents, FBI agents, agents of the Secret Service, also participating in what capacity. They weren't stopping it. The nature of what happened is focused on Trump things. But one thing I want to mention, since so much of this was validated by the University of Chicago's Department of Economics as fiction.
Well, I think what's really important for people here in the Chicago area to understand is that the University of Chicago created the economic plan. It was called the BRIC. It was implemented in Chile after the coup and was the foundation and inauguration of neoliberalism in the world, based on privatization of everything. I mean, they took away everybody's Social Security, everybody's health care, everybody's everything, except for the military. They kept theirs. In the early 1980s, there was a big effort to privatize government in this country. Private sector does it better. It's the same principle, to privatize everything so the corporations can make profit off of everything and the people have absolutely no access to what they need. It has destroyed the working class in almost every country in the world. In Chile, they destroyed the entire coastal waters, and Chile has a lot of coastal waters. It's a very long country. Because they farmed Atlantic salmon and used so many antibiotics and other things that the ocean floor died all along the Chilean coast. So if you're eating Chilean sea bass, let me tell you, you're not. They also tore down all these trees, which led to horrible drought because they wanted to plant Christmas trees for profit. The Chilean economy was highly industrialized and highly advanced until the coup, and it became totally dependent on the U.S. and foreign aid.
As an export market.
That's right. There's a quote I wanted to share. You know, I interviewed so many people, it's hard to keep track. But I interviewed this guy, Alan Silberman, from the State Department. He had served as labor attaché in various embassies in Latin America. And this is what he had to say about AFIELD. The bread and butter unionism of AFIELD is contrary totally to the reality of society so different from the U.S. Mainly in Latin America, such things as collective bargaining are absurd and will never attain the kind of political changes needed. What AFIELD does best, he stressed, is even more frustrating. They send people who usually have no understanding whatsoever of Latin America. They teach a brand of trade unionism which is ineffective and probably reactionary. They too often win friends through bribes and therefore become connected with the most corrupt sectors. And that is it exactly.
Because the University of Chicago is ground zero with its destruction of this planet, both in its role of producing an atomic weapon and for a destructive religion, neoliberalism.
It's fundamentalism for capitalism.
You're going to, on the 50th anniversary of the coup, have a demonstration, I understand.
No. Thought about that a lot. And people in this country don't know what neoliberalism is necessarily, let alone the University of Chicago's role in that. So to call a demonstration that most people will scratch their heads wouldn't make sense. I think we might try for a teaching film called Los Chicago Boys. It is a documentary with all the Chileans studying at the University of Chicago and then going back and destroying their own country. It's very good.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you for reminding us to be vigilant and to be responsible for what our government has done.
Because and workers need to understand the role of U.S. labor. And thank you. Bye.
WZRD Chicago.